Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and my co-host, as always, is the vivacious Vicki Nichols Goldstein.
Hello, everyone. And wait, David, what do you mean by vivacious?
According to Webster's Dictionary, it means full of life, lively, sprightly, in temper, conduct, or spirit. I think it even comes with a picture of you.
Okay, I'll take it.
Today we get to talk with Melanie McField, founder and director of Healthy Reefs for Healthy People. She developed and her group published the world's first science-based coral reef report card and, with a number of partners, recently released the latest report card on the health of the Mesoamerican reef that runs along the coast of Mexico and Central America. The Mesoamerican reef is the second largest coral reef system in the world after Australia's Great Barrier Reef. But before we get into whether it rates a B or an E, although I think your system's actually 1 through 5, let me ask you, Melanie, when did you first connect with the ocean?
Thanks for having me here. I'm from the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains in South Carolina, and we would take the annual vacation to the coast. And I just remember all day, every day, I was digging in the sand and rolling around. And I learned to swim when I was 3, and I loved it. I looked back at my high school yearbook when it says, what do you want to be when you grow up? It was like marine biologist. I already totally knew, convinced my parents I had to learn to scuba dive because it was a professional. I was going to need it for my profession. So I was like 15, got now, no, it was a NASDS certification was like what I could get in a lake in South Carolina when I was in high school.
So you went to school intending to be a marine biologist, and that's what you became?
Yes. Well, I did the study, kind of typical marine science at the University of South Carolina, but I did do 1 year abroad. That was 1 year living in England, and that just opened my eyes to like, wow, the world's very different in other countries, and that made me want to do Peace Corps. I wanted to go to grad school, but I said, I need a break. I'll join Peace Corps, and that sent me to Belize as a marine biologist for Holchan Marine Reserve. That was just fortuitous. That's the position I got sent to. And that set the course for the rest of my life, really, because I cashed in my plane ticket home and stuff and stayed in Belize.
That's about the best Peace Corps story I ever heard. What were you actually doing and how did you develop? As a scientist, you eventually came up with the idea of developing a report card for the reefs.
But I guess because I started with the management, like managing the marine protected area, working with that kind of data is what, you know, is needed to conserve and to manage reefs. Then I went to grad school and got exposed to academia and research, but I was still always interested in the practical side. So that's where this ties back. Research is totally amazing and interesting, and you need to dig into little fundamental things to unlock new understanding that then might become useful for management later. But I'm really nuts and bolts and want to fix things now and deal with what we can do to make the ecosystem better. And that's where the monitoring and evaluation comes in. You have to figure out like which components you should be monitoring. It's like going to the doctor, and in human health, we know what the main things are. And so when everybody goes to the doctor, you get a standard set of general health test, and there are indicators, and you have a range, and you know whether it's good or you're in the kind of danger zone or it's really bad. And we didn't have that for coral reefs. So we were doing all this monitoring and trying to understand if management actions are working, but then there's nothing really to compare it to, except at your one site over time, if it's getting better or worse. But then there are all these other factors that are also contributing to that, like hurricanes and bleaching events and things like that.
So it's a living system. It's complex, but you have to develop the diagnostics for its health.
You have to accept that you need to do the best you can. Even your health assessment from your doctor doesn't tell you everything. Things get missed. So we're not saying that our system is perfect. Our monitoring evaluation system won't give us every bit of information we need because it is so complex, but it's hitting the main points.
you put together the report card for the Mesoamerican Reef. Tell us more about the reef and what countries are included in the regional diagnostics, the whole shebang.
There are over 70 partners in this Healthy Reefs for Healthy People initiative, and they come from the four countries of Mexico, Belize, Guatemala, Honduras. They recognized in 97, there was a presidential and prime minister's decreed that the Mesoamerican Reef was a shared resource. Mm-hmm. So that was a big step. And the conservation community at that time was not very well connected. It was more national programs. This really helped. And we came in at around that same time in the early 2000s, trying to get groups to standardize a methodology. If you can all use the same method and share a database, then you can look at your data on a larger scale. So that was the carrot or the idea, is that everybody's going to benefit if we can do this together. And it started with a handful, more like the Bingos, the larger NGOs and some of the donors. And we just started doing it. We collected more partners as we've gone along. So it's always been this increase. And now it's, I think the last, this most recent report card had, just for that 1 year's sampling, diving, sampling the reef, the ecosystem, there were 99 different data collectors from 41 organizations. And we've managed to do it for now almost 20 years. It's really come along. Like, we wrote a book first to explain the concept of reef health. Within the scientific community, there was some antagonism, or like, they were worried about this idea of putting good and bad on indicators from the reef, because it's not perfect. And science likes to be very precise, and it's not precise because every reef has a different history and the depths, and there's a thousand caveats. But when you roll it all up and you look at it, the reef itself, it needs to have living coral. It needs to have enough coral to exist. It's a complex, it's a city. And so the corals are like the buildings in this city.
Can you tell us the categories of your report card?
There's four main indicators. And the four are the ones that the groups, everybody was monitoring these four. And they hit on fundamental structural and processes of the reef. We need to have the built structure. That's percent living coral. That's what everybody looks at, that one. That is like the most widespread indicator, and it's fundamental. The other one that's on the seabed, the benthic part, is the percent of fleshy macroalgae. And we want to have less of that. That's the competitor with corals for space. So it's like the weeds in this system. We want the redwood trees. And unlike the forest, the redwoods don't really have a problem fighting off weeds, as far as I know. But in the reef, they do, because the corals are so slow to grow. And these weeds, the macroalgae, are so fast to grow. That's impacted by herbivory. So how many fish are out there eating the algae? And that then again is linked to management, and how hard are we fishing those things, and are we regulating it? And then the other aspect is nutrients. So nutrients coming off the land, coming from the air, coming from subsurface deep well injection and stuff, that you're putting things into the groundwater and then it's getting out to the reef in a variety of ways.
So corals like a low nutrient environment, which feeds seaweeds and algae. And then those big parrotfish, if you have them, will come along and eat the algae off the coral, eat the coral poot sand. 70% of our white sand beaches.
So then the other two are fish. You mentioned the parrotfish. So it's them, and the surgeonfish is the other family. They're a little smaller. They're more prevalent in the shallower water. Those are the two main groups of herbivores. We need more of those on the reef. And then we look at the groupers and snappers as the key commercial species. And that's our indicator of how intact is this ecosystem in terms of fishing pressure. The fishing in the region is artisanal. It's not like big trawlers on the reef and huge gear issues. It's just the cumulative impact. When you're in a reef system, things grow slowly. There's not a lot of turnover. It's not like a temperate ecosystem where you have organisms with a short lifespan and they turn over and you can fish it hard. The coral reefs are really not like that. So even good fishing, it takes its toll. And we need places that are not fished. We need these fully protected zones.
Okay. Yeah. And again, the four categories we're looking at is coral cover, percentage of coral, the benthic community, the micro and macroalgae that could be smothering it, the herbivorous fish that are keeping it healthy, and the commercial fish that round it out.
The good news is overall, the reef health went up. This was the first time in 5 years where we had reef health went up, and that was all due to the fish. The previous report card was the data collected in 2021, and we missed 2020. That should have been data collection year, but due to COVID. And I think COVID also, the enforcement agencies were not out. People were allowed to go fish. In some countries, they said regulations are set aside, just go feed your families. That was the total priority. People needed to feed their families. And then when we went to monitoring 2021, there was a 50% decrease in these commercial fish. So it was very significant. And luckily that has reversed. In 2023, when we monitored, it was back to the way it had been. I call it the COVID blip. We needed the reef to feed people because when tourism completely locked down, it's very worrisome for how people are going to have money to feed their families. So fishing served to help support food security through that time. And we can see it, and I think that's what we're seeing. We can't say for sure, but we definitely saw this unusual drop and we saw it come back. Even with that return, it's still in poor condition. So we don't have the amount of commercial fish that we should. And we have very little regulations of fin fish. The focus on the fisheries, the big money is lobster and then conch.
Are you seeing that communities are going after the reef fish versus the commercial fish?
We have really focused on this since 2008, and they are coming back. So you see that. But then you saw the blip, the COVID blip or whatever it was, everything reduced, including those protected species, which also makes me think it was just the COVID, like lack of regulations and we need to eat. We did look at other fish that are not eaten, and they're mostly smaller fish, just to see if there was something else. Was there an anoxic event? We know the temperatures were not nearly as high as they were last year and the year before. But yeah, those that didn't have any decrease. So it did seem to be due to fishing. So whatever it was. And that's why we started pushing to have the parrotfish look at these parrotfish in terms of potential protection, because it will help the overall reef ecosystem. And that was because they're being like fished down the food chain. There's not as many groupers and snappers. So people start fishing the other things. And the parrotfish are large. They do give you an amount of weight in your fish burger. Like it's big enough to make a fillet. Some things are being caught that are barely big enough to make a fillet, like angelfish. Those have now been protected in Belize too, because that's like ridiculous to turn that into a skinny little fish finger. Lionfish make great fish fingers and ceviche.
Yeah. A lot of the islands and the regions along the Mesoamerican Reef are really promoting spearfishing for lionfish to help get divers and community groups engaged in their reductions. Has that helped at all? Are you looking at those?
Yeah, it has. Like it has helped. And you can see in the areas where those groups are. So it's often around the touristy areas. You get like a reduction. You don't see as many lionfish as we did initially, like when they first invaded. It does make a difference.
Now you say the major fisheries are like lobster and conch. Is there science on what impact it has on the reef when you take out those critters?
It's piecemeals. One study that stands out in my mind was about the fact that the lobsters feed on this corallivore snail. And that snail, if you don't have the lobsters to reduce their population, explodes and it transmits a coral disease. And it also eats coral tissue. But even worse than that, it transmits a disease. That's one way that the overfishing of lobster can contribute to coral disease.
Maybe you could talk about these larger, it's not just Mesoamerican reef, but globally, the coral bleaching linked to warming seas and also the diseases, which seem to be spreading globally, but particularly the hard coral diseases in the Caribbean. And
the Stony Cape.
Caribbean is really stressed. So that just maybe the nature of the basin and it's being smaller. The Pacific is just so vast. There's so much water and a turnover of the water. But our basin is this kind of circular enclosed sea. All of the river runoff from South America, from Central America, all the deposition, the atmospheric deposition from Africa, like we're getting it from everywhere, even the U.S., the Midlands, from the Gulf of Mexico. But I think the same pressures are there in most reefs around the world. It's just the which ones are the primary ones. The nutrients are not typically as primary a problem in a lot of the Pacific, unless it's right around a population center. Those islands that have a lot of people and no sewage treatment, that's where theirs is coming from.
Can we just take a moment to talk about sewage treatment? Are you seeing more improvements with water quality and sewage, or is it about the same that we've experienced in the last 20 years?
There's very little in the Mesoamerican reef region, because even if you get a good plant, you know that you have to have the budget to be able to maintain it and upkeep it. What we've seen is just high levels of human pathogen from fecal coliforms in the samples, in the water samples that were either from the coastline or from the reef. And then it's the nutrients on top of it. So the pathogens are one thing, and then just the nutrients that are coming out both from the land, the rivers, livestock, and agriculture are both important sources. But then the sewage being on these islands like where Ambergris Key, San Pedro is, it's a large population right on top of the reef.
Do you love the salty characters and ocean champions we have on The Rising Tide? So do we, and we're dedicated to bringing inspiring stories and voices that make waves. But here's the catch. We need your support to keep the tide rolling. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help keep The Rising Tide on the air and online. If you're ready and able to amplify these salty voices for the sea, dive in with a donation, big or small. Visit bluefront.org and join the movement. And now, back to the show.
You rate the Mesoamerican on 1 to 5. What is this latest report card say? What number does it have, and what are your hopes and fears?
Our number came out at 2.5, so we're halfway there. I was going to contact Bon Jovi and let's get a little song going. We're halfway there. Sadly, that's up from 2.3, but we did reach 2.8. So 2.8 would have been categorized as fair, so that got us a little bit up to the. We're now still in poor. Most of our assessments have been poor. So we got up to fair for, I think, two different assessments in a row, and then it went back. But we take encouragement from any little improvement. So the fact that the fish bounced back, it was a temporary thing, but we're going to see more coral losses because we didn't see that much. This sampling for this report card was done in 2023. But I'd say most of it, maybe two-thirds of it, was done before October. So we missed a lot of the mortality. We were there in the water when things were bleached, but it was not dead. And a lot of stuff died, like in November, December.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about bright spots in the beginning. From the bigger picture, can you tie in any conservation efforts with any of the bright spots in your findings?
I think the Cayman Crown is the one secret reef. It's in a very inaccessible location in some dirty water, mind you. It's not the clean, clear water that you normally see on reefs. It's right by the shipping channel going into Guatemala. It's the border region between the very southern end of Belize and the northern end of Guatemala. This is the disputed territory. So it's a tricky place to work. But there's a PBS special from last spring called Treasure of the Caribbean. You should watch it. It's gotten awards. It's great. It shows this area. It's amazing. And in that, we were speculating like why it didn't bleach, because it had not even bleached significantly. It did bleach, but it was a short-term bleaching and it recovered. That was from the 2017 bleaching, or so one of the previous ones. Mm-hmm. And so we were talking about like the fact that we called it Cayman Crown because it's the end of the Cayman Trench. It comes slices across there and this deep water begins to upwell. So it's some natural nutrient enrichment, which is not necessarily bad for corals. It's different types of nutrients and the configuration of it is different. It comes up and feeds the reefs and also have bathed it in a little cooler water. That was the idea. But then in 2024, it really bleached. It's not totally dead. It didn't have as significant mortality as a lot of places. This summer, we'll be back to be able to give it a little more quantitative story.
Do you have a lot of hope for these coral restoration projects in the future?
We need every scrap of coral we can get. They serve a solid role. We still have to fix the problems that killed the parents. The parent colonies were killed by these other things, sometimes bleaching, but also just the pollution from all this sewage and water quality. And those things are completely in the control of local managers. You can put stronger rules into hotels and even local populations for hooking up to sewage treatment and doing a better job of your sewage treatment. And riparian buffers, that's like, it's on the paper regulations of all the laws, and nobody enforces it. Keeping vegetation by the rivers really helps keep sediment and the nutrients from going out onto the reef.
What are your recommendations come out of this latest report card for local authorities, for the nations facing the Mesoamerican reef, and what response have you gotten?
It's the same recommendation we made in 2008 in the first report card. And that is full protection of 20%. So fish 80% using good practices, using regulations, all that, but set aside 20%. That's really the minimum. 30 by 30, but that's not full protection. So we agree with 30 by 30, but we've already got 56% protected. And that's a territorial sea. That's a bigger denominator. We've only got like 3% of that territorial sea mar wide, like under full protection. For coral reefs, it's a little better. With 11% of the coral reefs for the whole region are fully protected, so no fishing. You need to have these no fishing areas so you can have fish.
With enforcement.
With enforcement. We're still trying to figure out where you're going to put those areas. When they're such a cash cow for tourism, because luckily the fish don't seem to mind the tourists, the divers. They adapt to that. And you can have high value scuba diving, tourism, and snorkeling in these areas.
Is there the pressure, the citizen groups that can affect policy, increase enforcement, expand these protected areas? How much of that pressure is there now?
There is. There's also victimization. And even there have been a number of deaths in Honduras, particularly journalists and even conservationists. So it's people are careful, and it's not the same feel as in the US where people just really will speak out and state their mind very openly. But the conservation ethic is there, and people sign petitions, they make statements. You can look all over like local Facebook pages and people are commenting and they care deeply. Like people in the region, really, it's not just economics and the people that are benefiting from the reef. I feel like people consider the reef part of their patrimony.
Yeah. In addition to the people who are living there, think about all of the people that travel to those regions to recreate, to go diving, to go to the beach, and getting the communities, the tourism operators involved in the push for protection, whether it's wearing appropriate sunscreen that won't kill the reefs, all the way up to supporting the water quality initiatives, and just paying attention to how everybody can contribute would really be a big move if we can just expand this education to everybody who utilizes
it. And that's a lot more people. It's so valuable when people do ask. If you're in contact with the hotels, like you're considering staying somewhere, let them know, what are you doing with your sewage treatment? Are you participating in one of these Green Globe or eco certification programs? You need to ask those questions, because everybody's website will say, oh, we're eco-friendly. But if you don't ask a little, anybody can say that. They have to ask a little, go a little deeper and ask the questions of them. At least then they'll begin to hear that from all the people. Everybody's asking about these eco certifications.
Melody, as a scientist and activist and putting out this report card, what's your realistic hope for the state of the Mesoamerican reef going forward?
I have hope, because it's a large system. We need to be scaling up our conservation efforts. So I feel like the size of this is correct. We and the whole thing doesn't get hit by a hurricane in the same year. We have gotten hit by bleaching events the same, but there's still some variation among different parts of it. And we've got a network of dedicated conservation groups working on it. If any area of the world can survive, this is in those the top pool, largely because of the effort and the people that have been working on it for so long. We've also got a huge variety of reef types, and some of these inshore reefs that are in the murky waters on this along this continental coast, they've got some secrets. Those corals have been dealing with things that the, I call them the prima donna reefs that are out on the atolls, like where all the dive boats go. They're prima donnas. They need for everything to be just right. So we have some tough reefs. They're like street kids. They can skin their knee and they don't need antibiotic. They've got it inside. So that's my hope, is that we've got to take more. And that's what some of the restoration projects are doing. They're looking for those strong brood stock and pulling that into their effort. So that can help accelerate what would be a natural process of some living and surviving under new conditions. The challenge is the conditions are changing so fast. So restoration, if it's smart and it looks at this and takes all this into consideration, we help keep up with the pace of the change going on. So we're talking to each other, and the collaboration is really what makes it work a lot faster. So I do have hope.
Melanie, we are so glad for your work and your energy. And thank you so much, Melanie McField, Director of Healthy Reefs for Healthy People, for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, guys. And visit our website, everyone, and download the report card. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helbart and me, Vicki Nichols-Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, Kelly Bates, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the blue frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky! There you are, good boy, Sparky!